Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content and pays for it. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now, here's Bruce Ash.
Hello, insiders, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. This is your host, Bruce Ash, along with co-host
Ed Wilkinson,
welcoming you to a special pre-Thanksgiving edition of Inside Track. Thanks for tuning in today, either on the radio or through your favorite electronic device. We have another great show for you. Starting off the show, we'll hear from Dr. Jack McGettigan from Quality of Life Medical. His lab has been very busy heading up research for a China virus cure with Moderna, who announced a nearly 95% success rate with their virus vaccine testing this week. Dr. McGettigan will give us an insider's update. We'll also reunite with friend of the show, Onita Davis, to talk about Wreaths Across America. This is the season for big fundraising as our fundraising drive arrives for wreath laying to honor our veterans here and across America. In the second half of today's show, we'll hear from author Michel Paradis. His book, Last Mission to Tokyo, caught my eye recently when the Wall Street Journal highlighted it in their Saturday review section. His book takes a serious look at the Japanese war trials for the men who were tortured after the Doolittle raid, and also those trials that the Imperial War Staff were subjected to after the war was over. This portion of the show is brought to you by one of our newest sponsors, Essential Termite and Pest Control. Essential Pest Control is a great local company I've depended upon for our business and in my own home for over 30 years. Essential Pest Control is an industry leader. Essential solves all sorts of pest problems, and I trust each of their trained staff in my own home and around our puppies, which says a great deal for the respect I have for my friend, local owner, Eric Rudin, who runs Essential Pest Control with integrity and a focus on safety and customer service. Essential Pest Control, a company you can trust. Now, to our first guest, Dr. Jack McGettigan from Quality of Life Medical. Dr. McGettigan, how goes the Operation Warp Speed Enhanced Moderna trials you and your staff have been working on since this past summer? Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me.
How goes it?
It's going very well. As I think I heard on an intro there, we were very surprised and amazed and very pleased, I think, with the recent announcement of how effective the vaccine appears to be and how efficacious it is, which was a very good, you know, like a pat on the back for us for the efforts we put forward, hoping we might be able to do something to help stem this problem. So we're all very elated and kind of proud to be just part of that endeavor.
I know that you're a pretty self-effacing guy, Dr. McGettigan, and I don't mean to embarrass you, but in my eyes, you are a medical hero, and you and your entire staff, they have been great. And in my recent visits at your office, everything that you guys have done has been absolutely appropriate, medically, just at the highest possible levels. So, kudos to you and the staff. Like I said, you guys, you're on the forefront of all this. Now, the recent news from Moderna on the effectiveness of their new China virus vaccine was pretty spectacular. The CDC and others have praised its effectiveness and diversity of subjects. What does it mean for an answer to this most significant public health emergency in decades?
Well, I think from what I don't have all the answers. I wish I did. I am low on the totem pole on this whole operation, but we are kind of the ground troops, working in the trenches. The fact that this vaccine appears to be so effective, and hopefully they're going to get an emergency use license so that they can make it available to us as soon as possible. And the things I'm hearing from the powers that be are that hopefully sometime in December they may be releasing some vaccine. The frustrating thing I think that we're all going to put up with is that they cannot make hundreds of millions of doses of this overnight. Mm-hmm. I've heard that they're going to be releasing probably about 20 million doses initially, maybe in December. And so then that somebody's going to have to figure out, okay, who gets those 20 million doses?
Mm-hmm.
And thank goodness I'm not the one who has to decide that.
So one of the most significant aspects of the Moderna vaccine is the ease of delivery. No need for super cold storage. How does this help Moderna deliver the vaccine more effectively than the other pharma companies? I mean, will it be easier for Moderna to get as wide a distribution as possible versus, say, Pfizer and others that might have to do this, very, very cold storage?
Well, I think Pfizer has a little bit of a unique challenge, but it's not an insurmountable one. Certainly, there's not a lot of people that have a minus 70 or lower freezer available. We happen to have one just because we do a lot of research that requires it, but most doctor's offices wouldn't have it. I think most pharmacists will not have it. But the way the government's behind this whole thing, I wouldn't be surprised to see them possibly deliver those to those kind of places. So, it's yet to be determined. I think what I've heard was that probably Pfizer's will be sent more to large institutions, hospitals, maybe university settings, where they probably would have those capabilities right off the bat, and maybe, gear up the other places that might need that. But fortunately, Moderna's won't require that, and maybe future other candidates that are coming won't require that either. That I'm not privy to. I do know we're going to be working with another candidate here probably next week that doesn't require that kind of storage either.
So that actually brings up the next question I was going to raise. My co-host here, Eb Wilkinson, and I have talked about his participation in the Moderna trials, which that's now closed, right, Jack?
It's closed. They've got their 30,000 plus subjects that they needed.
Dang.
But there are the good news is we really do need many more than two vaccines to take care of the United States, to take care of the global needs. And so there are several other candidates that are still involved with the Warp Speed project, of which we're, this whole Moderna, Pfizer, and AstraZeneca, I believe, is part of that. I think there's six different pharmaceutical companies, but there's also many other pharmaceutical companies that are working on this too. So I think if the public out there is interested in helping come up with a solution, that if they hear of any potential trials that they might want to, if they're so inclined to help, that they certainly would be welcome.
Do you have any trials coming up?
That's one coming up.
We do have a study. We actually got two studies coming, one that we're theoretically going to be enrolling potentially this next week and probably through December, maybe even through January. We have another major pharmaceutical company that's asked us to start with them in March. So these studies and these vaccine trials are going to be going on for a while. We don't know how long the Pfizer one or the Moderna one are going to last as far as how long the benefit will be there. So that's one of the things that is going to need to be looked at over the coming 2 years, which all of these trials pretty much have very identical protocols that require 2 years worth of kind of follow-up of the subjects in them. The one thing that's, I think, been alluded to on a couple phone calls that I was privileged to be on with Dr. Fauci and our Surgeon General was that as these different vaccines get approved, which hopefully the Pfizer and the Moderna one look like the first two that could very possibly be approved for distribution, again, as early as, possibly November, but more likely December, that the people in those studies that got the placebo will more than likely have the option, I believe, of getting the real thing. And I think they certainly deserve to be on the top of the list.
Yeah.
So how do I sign up for the study?
If somebody's interested in helping us, they can certainly reach out. I'll give out my personal phone line and feel free to leave a voice message just with your name and phone number. And that's area code 520-495-5169. You also can call our regular phone number, which is the 520-733-2250. Leave a message there. Anybody who wants to call me, though, and leave a name and number, I will gladly get them on the list. And right now, for this new one that we're starting, we do have still quite a few folks that signed up for the Moderna one that we could not get into it, and we're going to be going through that list.
Give me that number one more time.
My personal line, my office phone number is 520-495-5169.
Okay.
And the regular clinic number is the 520-733-2250.
Great, Jack. So I have two questions for you. One is a kind of a technical question. When somebody has received the vaccine, they have the antibodies to protect them from the virus, but can they still potentially be carriers of the virus once they have that immunity or lack of vulnerability to the virus themselves?
Well, you had to stump me, didn't you? I don't know that we know the answer to that question at the moment. I mean, there's a lot of things that are going to be looked at as these trials go forward. That's certainly, I think, one of the things that is on the list. That the bigger one, I think, though, is let's say you did get the vaccine and you hopefully have that 95% immunity. There's 5% that, what about those people? Well, theoretically, and in the Moderna study and in the Pfizer study, they were people who got the vaccine but did still come down with COVID. I think the good news there so far is that the severity of the illness that they got is significantly less overall than the one that somebody would get that has no protection. The other big question, though, that all of us kind of need to be, looking forward to is just how long are you protected?
Is
this a once-in-a-lifetime vaccine? Probably not. So, those are questions that we're just going to have to answer, in the coming months and years as we understand this virus better.
Well, Dr. McGettigan, thanks very much. Like I said, you are my medical hero, and you have done a great job in all of my dealings with you. I would heartily encourage anybody who is thinking that they might want to be a subject and a medical hero themselves in this entire medical project to please call either Jack McGettigan at 495-1569, 5169. Sorry about that. My dyslexia kicking in. 495-5169 or the clinic at 733-2250 at the speed of the pen. Dr. McGettigan, thanks very much. Hope to have you on again real soon. And thanks for joining us, everybody. We're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we return, we'll be speaking with Onita Davis about Wreaths Across America. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back. Jamie Kipper and her father, Gary Kipper, from Tucson Iron and Metal. What are they going to see when they come through the gates?
So when they come on in, they'll see our building up front. People have free rein to then go out and look in the yard. So it's not a typical scrapyard with a ton of big machinery. We have a couple of forklifts around, but that's about it just to help move material. So when you come in, it's all organized by material, whether it's square tubing, angle iron, roofing, and then there is a pile in the back, which is still organized and easy to get through, but that's stuff that comes over from the scrap. So we're unique in that we get stuff in from the scrap, which a lot of artists and people will like or reuse, whether it's a sink that someone needs for their house. We sell literally anything made of metal.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Wouldn't it be great if political leaders could create that country again? Learn how to do exactly that, one family at a time, with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911, 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Many thanks to our great supporters of Inside Track, our newest advertiser, Eric Rudin, and his great service team at Essential Pest Control. Gary Imus, and my Inside Track partner, Eb Wilkinson at Imus Wilkinson Asset Management. Jamie Kipper and her dad, Gary Kipper, from Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, and the kids from Corazon Cabinets, Joy, Allie, and David. I do business with all of them. So should you. Speaking of Corazon, do you have a great home improvement project you want to start, but you're worried if you can afford the luxury you deserve? Corazon Cabinets sells J&K, Conestoga, and Waypoint Cabinets. Plus, Corazon offers professional design resources for your home. Call Corazon Cabinets at 488-2266 and schedule a visit to the showroom at 4700 South Park. That's their new showroom. That's an easy number to remember for your contact, 488-2266. The Corazon move to their new showroom at 4700 South Park is complete. Corazon Cabinets, luxury you can afford. Okay.
And I will be down there this
week.
Yeah.
You've been saying that now for 3 months now. I'll believe it when I see it. Put up or shut up, buddy. Okay.
You got it.
Okay. Our guest and friend of the show, Anita Davis, is a local activist who helps a cause very close to my heart and to Eb's heart, and it's Wreaths Across America. Anita, welcome. The Wreaths Project is nationwide, but we raise money right here in Southern Arizona, don't we?
Correct. And thanks for having me. And for those of you who do not know a lot about Wreaths Across America, not only is it nationwide, but it's also international now,
yeah,
which I will speak to in just a minute. But for us locally, each of our local cemeteries does participate in Wreaths Across America. And so if you have not considered donating a wreath or part of a wreath or whatever you can afford to donate, we'd like to encourage you to do that because there are only 10 days left.
That's right.
Before the deadline, which is November 30th.
Mm. So Anita, how many veterans here in Tucson have been laid to rest that we know about?
Wow. Let me just give you three figures that I know off the top of my head. Evergreen has over 13,000, which includes Civil War veterans. I didn't know it, but Holy Hope has about the same number. The new cemetery, the Arizona Veterans Memorial Cemetery in Marana, the one that my unit has chosen to support, while we'll support all of them, Marana has a special place in our hearts, and they now have 1,400 veterans, and they've only been open for, what, 3-4 years?
Right.
So when you throw in East Lawn, South Lawn, Sierra Vista,
right,
which used to be our designated state Veterans Memorial Cemetery, but now we don't have to drive that far, we're talking about a great many veterans buried right here in Tucson.
So this is really a huge, daunting project.
Yes,
getting enough wreaths for every of these men and women. How many didn't get that support last year because we just didn't raise enough money?
Right, and I only know Marana because that's the one that mm-hmm. I'm tracking, and we were short over 300 wreaths last year. We were devastated because that's a small cemetery and we've always been able to cover every veteran's headstone. So out of a little over 1,000 veterans, we only had about 800 wreaths.
How much are the wreaths?
$15. And they are handmade, real wreaths. I get a lot of questions about, well, what do they look like, and are they fake? No.
You can smell those beautiful, that beautiful scent that comes from, these are live, they're
wonderful.
These
are live wreaths, and they are shipped from Maine, which is where the trees are grown.
In big refrigerator trucks.
And all volunteers driving the trucks. So
wow.
I think.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That is
over
cool.
600 trucks are used to convey the wreaths to the different locations, and it's all by donated trucks and volunteer drivers. One of the things that I'd like to share with people real quickly, in case they don't know a lot about wreaths, and then I want to talk about, so what are the different cemeteries doing? Because Wreaths Across America is trying very hard to make sure that they abide by the COVID rules. And so We're grateful that we're going to be able to do Reefs Across America. As many of you may have heard, we thought that Arlington was going to be canceled. And Arlington is a special place for our Gold Star families. And so we were very upset, to say the least, when we found out we would not be able to lay reefs. But that decision has been reversed. They are going to take steps to keep everyone safe, but the reef laying will take place. So we've been doing this since 1992, not me personally, but Reefs Across America has been laying reefs since 1992. And then in 2018, and I think we talked about this the last time I was with you, we went international. So in 2018, they laid reefs in Normandy, and they laid 9,367 reefs. Last year, Luxembourg,
wow,
and the Netherlands, and we laid 1,364 reefs. So I just think that that's a wonderful addition to our mission, to be able to recognize our not only soldiers, but sailors and airmen who died offshore.
You know,
that they are not forgotten, even though they are on foreign soil.
Onita, I was at the American Cemetery above Omaha Beach on the 75th anniversary of D-Day. I spent hours there with my wife walking all the rows, reading the headstones of the thousands of young men who lost their lives that morning of June 6th, 1944. And so many who died that day and the days which immediately followed. And I wondered about their surviving families, you know, their brothers and sisters and wives and children they left behind. We have veterans, our own veterans cemetery in Marana. A friend of the show, Sean Fund, has been very active, actually bringing new veteran remains, you know, to that cemetery. We owe so much to our brave warriors. I mean, look, I'm not a veteran. Eb is, and I know you have, you know, great affiliations yourself, you know, within the veteran community. This Reefs Across America, I think it's a godly thing. It really is.
And if you have not experienced the service, and that's a good lead in to, so where are we this year with Reefs Across America here locally? If you have not had an opportunity to participate, I know that Marana will be doing their normal short ceremony that we do before the laying of the reefs. Mm-hmm. They will be doing it, but unfortunately, it is going to be virtual. They have a limit as to how many people can be present in the cemetery at one time, and so we will not be allowed to open the reef laying to the general public as we've done in the past. But the Veterans Service Organizations, so the Combat Veterans, American Legion, VFW, will lay the reefs. We will lay every single reef that was donated. I understand that there's some fairly stringent guidelines for Arlington. Arlington has, what, approximately 254,000 headstones to be covered. And so I'm not sure how they're good. They sent us a big handbook on how to do it that I haven't had a chance to review yet, but they are going to be laying the reefs. Now, let's backtrack a little bit to here in Tucson. Mm-hmm. At the Marana Cemetery, what they're planning to do is Friday, December the 18th, if a family has requested a grave-specific reef. In other words, you have the option at some cemeteries to say, this is where my father's buried. Would you please make sure a reef is placed for him? So on that Friday, the 18th of December, they are going to allow family members to come and lay reefs. You must check with the cemetery before you go out.
Holy Hope, East Lawn.
Marana is going to do it for Holy Hope, East Lawn, and Evergreen I really urge you to call. You can call anytime, because each cemetery has different rules. And so I don't want to dissuade
you. But the main thing
you.
Is these wreaths are going to be placed.
They are going to be placed.
And, absolutely.
And I think that if other cemeteries find out that what we're doing is that we're going to split it into 2 days, that maybe that will give some people an idea about how they can, they might handle the traffic.
Right. So how do they actually make a gift for Wreaths Across America?
Okay, well, thank you for asking. You can go to wreathsacrossamerica.org/AZ, as in Arizona, 0011, P as in Paul, and that will take you to our particular website, and you can donate to any local cemetery from our website.
If somebody wanted to contact you, how would they do that?
If they went to that particular website, up in the corner, it says contact us, and you are a great straight person.
George Burns. You're Gracie Allen, I guess.
We have been blessed by a generous gift by the Hilton El Conquistador Hotel. They have given us 2 one-night stays at the hotel, given that, you know, we have Thanksgiving coming up, we have Christmas coming up, perhaps you have someone coming to town. If you place an order between today and the 30th, for 2 or more wreaths, and you go on my website, again, www.wreathsacrossamerica.org/AZ0011P as in Paul, you will see contact us up in the right-hand corner. If you send me your order number, your name, and how I can reach you, email or telephone number, your name will be put in for a drawing to win one of those 2 certificates. And this is just our way of trying to encourage people to participate in Wreaths Across America.
Well, Onita, as I said, I believe very much that this is godly work. And just as last year, I'm going to hand you a check from my wife and myself.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sliding it underneath the monitors to you in our sanitary studios. In the Jewish religion, 18 means life.
Yes.
And these men and women who either gave their life in the service of our country or who served honorably and went on to live a full life, there's life to each of those people. I give in multiples of 10. And Wreaths Across America is a wonderful cause to support. Eb, you're a veteran yourself.
Yep.
And I heartily encourage, whether you're a veteran or not, like I said, I wasn't able to serve myself. But anybody who wants to get involved in Wreaths Across America, Eb, give that email. I assume that website.
I'll let her do it because I can't read the thing. I've got it up here right now. I'm ready to make a gift.
No problem. wreathsacrossamerica.org/AZ0011P. And if you go to the Marana website on the 19th of December, the Marana Cemetery website, they will be live streaming their service. Or you can contact their location coordinator, just like you contacted me when you're on the Marana Cemetery website in Wreaths Across America. You can send a message to Lori Ann, and she's also going to live stream it on her personal Facebook page.
Onita had a heck of a time finding me this fall, but next year we're going to connect much earlier. Wreaths Across America, Onita, contact her. Go to the wreathsacrossamerica.org website. You can contact Onita Davis directly at 229-1064. We'll be right back after we hear from some of the great folks who kindly support our show. Remember, support Wreaths Across America. When we return, we'll hear from best-selling author on his new book, Last Mission to Tokyo, Michelle Parody. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back. Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
A lot of the cities and the counties around have initiatives for artists. I think we're one of the premier artist suppliers for steel. First Saturday of every month, you can come down early and actually go through the scrapyard across the street. It's 7 acres of metal. You can walk through with our people and pick out what you want. It's always interesting to see what the artists have done. We've done actually a couple projects with the U of A engineering department and music department, where the engineering music students came down together. They had to pick something out of the scrap, and they had to build an instrument. And we have one of those in front of the plant. Some really cool things come out of the scrap.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday. I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all of the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices.
I'm Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. I don't ever want you to be dependent on government ever again. I want you to become financially independent. You will never, ever have to depend on socialist security for your survival. We are here to guide you to financial independence. That's imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. This portion of Inside Track is brought to you by our friends at Essential Pest Control, a company you can trust. Our special guest for the balance of this afternoon show is best-selling author Michel Paradis. His book, published by Simon & Schuster, is entitled Last Mission to Tokyo, The Extraordinary Story of the Doolittle Raiders and Their Fight for Freedom. On this date, November 20th, 1945, 75 years ago, the famous Nuremberg German war trials began. Even 75 years later, much is known about the war trials for German war atrocities, which ran nearly a year, but not as much about what happened in Japan. A few weeks back, a book review on Last Mission to Tokyo, The Extraordinary Story of the Doolittle Raiders and Their Final Fight for Justice was in the Wall Street Journal, and it caught my attention because while we know plenty about the German war trials, it seems to me much less is known about the devastating war atrocities committed by the Imperial Japan against innocent citizens as well as the allies of the United Nations, which were in many ways just as evil as those inflicted by the Nazis in Germany. Welcome to Inside Track, Mr. Paradis.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. You spent over a decade at the Department of Defense. You're a lawyer and a scholar, a lecturer at Columbia Law, where your subjects taught, I think this is really interesting, include the law of war and in the areas of international law and human rights. You had experience with court cases arising out of the alleged abuses at Guantanamo Bay over a decade ago. There have been movies and many, many books on the Nuremberg trials. Why do you think not as much is known about the Japanese war trials? Any thoughts there?
It's a great question. And I say that 100% agreeing with you as someone who works and teaches in this field. We've always paid much more attention to Europe. I think one reason is German's a lot easier to read than Japanese, to be perfectly honest with you. I think it's just a lot harder to get your head around a lot of what happened in the Pacific. I think there's also just a lot more, you know, ambiguity about it. It's something that, you know, the war in the Pacific was always just a much, you know, it starts with Pearl Harbor. It ends with the atomic bombings. It's a brutal war, as you were mentioning in your lead up. Mm-hmm. And It's just something that it's just so hard to get your head around. Whereas the European theater, you know, as unquestionably brutal as it is, we all know the beats of it pretty well, right? It's the invasion at Normandy, up through the charge through Berlin. You have the Eastern Front against the Soviets. It's just something I think people can get their heads around, including lawyers like myself, much more easily than the Pacific. But the Pacific is just an incredibly rich vein of stories, human stories, of atrocities, of incredible bravery, of incredible strength in the face of adversity that hopefully my book contributes to a growing literature of that brings those stories back to people who might not have heard of them before.
My co-host Eb Wilkinson is a Marine aviator while he served actively, and he knows the story as I do in our age group in early 1942, 16 B-25 Mitchell bombers were hurriedly launched off the deck of the USS Hornet because the ship had been spotted by a Japanese observer plane. I think I've got that story straight.
Picket boat. It was a boat.
Oh, picket boat. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And we sunk that boat. So.
I understand that their mission from a military standpoint was not necessarily a devastating blow to the Japanese war machine, but I think you'd agree it certainly did inform the Japanese people and government they were vulnerable themselves, and it was a great moral shot in the arm for American civilians and the military immediately after the Pearl Harbor attack and before the great naval battles which were soon to follow in the Pacific. So, Michelle, due to the extra 200 miles the air crews had to fly beyond their intended mission plan, those aircraft had to ditch in the sea or crash landed in China short of a safe airfield. I think there was only one air crew that actually landed regular-like on an airfield. Your story in Last Mission to Tokyo is about the 8 surviving American airmen who were members of the Doolittle Raiders, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you said it really well. I mean, one of the most, I think, remarkable things about the Doolittle Raid is that this impossible mission, and I don't use that word exaggeratedly. In 1942, it was impossible to fly a plane from U.S. territory over Japan. And Jimmy Doolittle, through just kind of a classic American ingenuity and engineering, solved that problem. But it came at a great cost to 8 men. Most of Doolittle's raiders miraculously, in fact, escaped to safety and became some of the greatest heroes of the war. But where my book takes off, no pun intended, is the story of the 8 raiders who don't make it home, who are captured by the Japanese in China, taken into custody by the Kempei Tai, which is Japan's secret police, tortured in extraordinarily, breathtakingly brutal ways. And ultimately put before a show trial in Shanghai that the Japanese conduct in order to execute them, essentially just as a pretext to execute them, to make, as I describe it in the book, to come up with the paperwork for murder. And that's the story I try to tell in this book, which I think had largely been forgotten. Obviously the Doolittle Raid is something that's people know a lot about. It's been the subject of some good movies and some not so good movies,
right?
But riveting movies all the same. But this story is a really deeply human story. It's a story of survival and suffering and revenge and justice that just really struck me as soon as I came across it, and I feel really privileged to be able to bring it to an American audience for the first time.
So your book really focuses on justice for the atrocities committed by Warden Sotojiro Tatsuda and his fellow Japanese officers at the Jinwan military prison. Tell our prisoners what. Tell our prisoners,
oh my God!
Tell our listeners. I'm sorry.
They feel like prisoners right now.
Yeah. Tell our listeners, please, Michelle. What happened there? What happened in that military prison?
Sure. Well, it wasn't just there. It was around China. Basically what happens is the Kempei Tai take these Doolittle Raiders in. And as you mentioned in the lead up, the Dual Array itself can't be overstated in terms of its significance, not only for giving, you know, the United States morale a nice boost, but for really just shaking to the very core the Japanese sense of exceptionalism that they had really waged this war on the basis of. Japan had not, the mainland of Japan had not been attacked in its recorded history. No one had succeeded. Even Genghis Khan, when he tried, tried to come across, tried to cross the Strait of Japan and was blown away by a freak hurricane, a typhoon that blew his armada asunder. And it went down in Japanese lore as, in a word that I'm sure many of your listeners will remember, as the divine wind, which in Japanese is the kamikaze.
Right.
So the Japanese just had this deep sense that they were invulnerable, and history had borne that out. And so when the Doolittle Raiders, you know, as you said, it's not a massively significant operation, but they hit some, you know, they hit the capital, they hit Tokyo. And not a single plane is shot down. There is a desire for revenge like you can't imagine. And so the tortures they vest upon the captured Doolittle Raiders are just stunning. It's things like waterboarding. It's things like sleep deprivation, of being hung from your hands overnight. Of, you know, they're one of the raiders who I focus on is a, you know, a young man from Cache, Utah, Cache County, Utah, named Chase Nielsen, who described in vivid detail having his hand pinned to a table as they stabbed between the webbing of his fingers with a pointy stick that he described to look that looked a bit like a pencil, but was sharp enough to go through the skin and down into the nerves. And it was a kind of pain he described as just utterly blinding. It was like nothing he had ever felt before. These were, you know, experts in the art of brutality and sadism. And at another point, they grab him, make him kneel on the floor, they put a broom handle behind his knees, and then they force him back to the ground and begin stomping on his thighs to essentially leverage his knee joints apart. And just, you know, you can feel that in your gut, just to think about that kind of suffering. So the just the raw brutality of it was breathtaking. And but I'll mention one thing, though, because this caught me up. Even as someone who works in the legal field as a human rights lawyer, the thing that the Doolittle Raiders, the ones who survived, and their rescue is, you know, a great part of the story all by itself. But the few who survived this treatment in Japanese custody, the thing they all complained about the most, the thing they said had, was the hardest to take, the worst to endure, was solitary confinement. They had spent 23 hours a day in most cases, 23 and a half hours a day in most cases, just in a cell by themselves. And it leads to a kind of madness. And I remember reading, when I read John McCain's memoir, he said the same thing, that, you know, of all the tortures visited upon him by the North Vietnamese, the solitary confinement was the one that just, you know, it kind of breaks the soul, and was the hardest to endure. And that was something, you know, I try my best anyway as a writer to convey to people how they just tried to cope with that and endure.
So all of this torture and deprivation was designed to create a case for a trial, a show trial. Can you talk about that trial that existed for these men?
Yeah, absolutely. So the you know, these eight raiders are captured by the Japanese, and immediately inside the Japanese cabinet, a fight breaks out, where you have, you know, real hardliners like the Army Chief of Staff, Hajime Sugiyama, who says that the Doolittle Raiders should just be publicly executed as spectacularly as possible, right? They should be beheaded as a way of deterring Americans from doing this ever again. But what was fascinating to me was to learn that, you know, the Japanese government was kind of a complicated thing. And you also had people in, like, Foreign Minister Togo say that, no, we have to treat them as prisoners of war, consistent with the Geneva Convention. Japan had, in fact, been the first country in 1929 to sign the Geneva Conventions, but then embraced essentially this militarist fascism as the 30s went by. That had led it, obviously, and become the pariah state that attacked Pearl Harbor. But there were still remnants of that old idealistic Japan. And so this debate breaks out as to what to do with the dual liberators. You have one part of the government saying execute them. You have another part of the government saying no, treat them as prisoners. And what Tojo, who is the prime minister, ultimately does is he goes to the war ministry and he asks the lawyers. And he's like, is there a legal way that we can execute these people, and essentially as a compromise? And the lawyers initially come back to him and say, no, right? Absolutely not. No, of course, murder is always wrong. And the message gets sent back down to the lawyers in the Japanese war ministry. No, 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 you don't understand. If we don't come up with a legal way of executing them, the Kempei Tai, who's been torturing them, is going to kill them anyway. And they'll say, you know, they were trying to escape. They'll say it was an accident. No one will believe it. It'll be a public relations and political catastrophe. So we have to find a legal way to do it. And so the lawyers in the war ministry, you know, just drank an extra pot of coffee to come up with a rationalization for murder. And what they came up with was to pass an ex post facto law called the Enemy Airmen's Law of 1942, which authorized the Japanese army to conduct war crimes trials of any American who committed atrocities against the Japanese with an airplane. And so, you know, starting with the premise of this ex post facto law, which they wrote just to be careful and just to be sure that couldn't apply to Japanese soldiers, right? Only American soldiers could be subjected to this law. They convene this show trial, and then they're stuck. They're like, wait a minute, we need evidence. And sure enough, what evidence gets brought forward? Well, supposed confessions from the dual liberators to committing atrocities that end up becoming the essentially the signatures on the death warrants. And they're all convicted.
So I'm not. I wasn't clear. I wasn't clear. Judge Okada, who I think oversaw that trial, was he later tried in the war trials?
So yes, and so this is really the crux of what my book is about, is telling that story, but from the perspective of 1945 and 1946, because after the war, the U.S. Army in China decides that we need to get justice for the dual liberators. In fact, President Roosevelt had promised as much when word of the execution and torture of the dual liberators first surfaced in 1943. And so what the Army does is they say, okay, and I tell the story essentially, much of the book is essentially the story of this young, he's young to me, he's 40, and so that to me is still young, young Army lawyer who is stationed in Japan who gets the file. And they say, figure out who to prosecute. And he's confronted with this really difficult problem. Who do we prosecute? It could go all the way up to the emperor. And what he hits upon, which is a real, almost miraculous innovation, a real great leap forward in kind of bringing truth, justice, and the American way to international law, to making things that used to be kind of just, you know, local ideas that, and ideals that we had in the United States to be part of, you know, universal human rights. Is he rounds up the lawyers and the judges, and he says, you, lawyers and judges, are the ones who are most responsible for the torture and murder of the dual liberators, even though you didn't get your hands dirty. All the torture was essentially laundered through your decision to convict these men on the basis of tainted evidence. The fact that some were executed as a consequence of these convictions and some others died in prison, the consequence of these convictions and were held in solitary confinement falls to you. You, even though you were not the one personally abusing them, you were the one most responsible because you essentially perverted justice.
Well, now there were only three that actually were executed by firing squad. The other,
that's right.
The other five did die in prison, but you know, all eight ended up dying.
Well, so no, just to be clear, so three are executed. Initially, all eight are sentenced to death.
Right.
And it goes up to Emperor Hirohito, who ostensibly, as a matter of his mercy, decides to commute the sentences of the other five. Really, what it is politically, that I think they want to have some hostages, some high-value hostages, in case they ever need to negotiate with the Americans. But what ends up happening is three are executed in October of 1942, the rest are put into prison with, quote, special conditions, which is this solitary confinement, but also, you know, great medical deprivation, food deprivation. One dies in prison of starvation. Another is on the verge of death in August of 1945 when in a Office of Strategic Services raid on a POW camp outside of Beijing, China, of all places. They stumble upon the four surviving Doolittle Raiders. And, you know, without getting too much into some of the spoilers and hopefully things that people find fun and enjoyable about the book, it's like Lazarus coming back from the dead. Everyone thinks all of the Doolittle Raiders, as you said, are dead. In fact, there's a movie that Hollywood releases in 1944, which is actually pretty good. It holds up. It's called The Purple Heart, in which it imagines what had happened to the eight lost Doolittle Raiders. It imagines their torture, imagines their show trial, and imagines their execution. And so when it turns out in August of 1945, just as this war, you know, this brutal war has ended, that four of the Doolittle Raiders survived, it's just this, you know, again, miraculous moment of celebration, because, you know, at the time, you know, the Doolittle Raid sort of has faded, I think, to some extent in, you know, in the memory of World War II, behind things like the D-Day invasion, behind things like Okinawa and many other really, you know, obviously pivotal moments throughout the war. But to those who lived through it, the Doolittle Raid was just, you know, an electric, the first real victory of the Second World War. And the Doolittle Raiders were the most celebrated heroes in some ways of the war.
Michelle, I'm going to find out. Michelle, yeah, we got only about a minute 45 remaining before the show ends. I have a key question that I want to ask, and I'm sorry I didn't get to it sooner. You worked at the Department of Defense. You were involved with the Guantanamo cases that came up. What did America learn? And I realize this is a very short answer that I'm only allowing you to give, but what did America learn from this in World War II, and what lessons did we maybe fail to learn?
Sure, that's a great question. I think the biggest lesson we did learn, and we always have to relearn in every generation, is that the rule of law, that justice, is a universal value for a good reason, because it not only separates us from our most barbaric enemies, like the Imperial Japanese, but it also makes us proud, right? It gives us an opportunity to make a historical record that is unambiguous about right and wrong in history, and to ensure that we are the ones who can hold our heads high, as we should. I mean, you know, it's one of the greatest nations that has ever existed, and one of the main reasons is that we have always stood by and fought for values as universal values around the world that we respect. Some of the lessons we forget are that it's sometimes hard to do that, and that's one of the things I certainly confronted when I was working on these issues during the Bush administration in the Department of Defense. That, you know, sometimes under pressure, right, under fear, under anxiety, under a desire to get revenge, it becomes really easy to sideline our values, to at least want to come up with excuses or workarounds.
Michelle, we're up against it. It's the end of the show. We're going to come back. I have another show that I want you to appear on, because this is a fascinating story. That's where we're going to leave it for today. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week. Wishing you a happy Thanksgiving, and see us next Saturday for a special Thanks to Giving show. Good afternoon.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
What other kind of customers do you have?
So our biggest customers are actually like ranchers and people from outside of the Tucson area. They're buying a lot of square tubing. They're buying a lot of stuff for their ranch to close off fences.
We'll sell anything from 10 feet to 10,000 feet to somebody that comes in, because we have new steel and surplus steel from steel mills. The reason we're able to get such good pricing on some of this stuff is, A, we sell scrap to the mill. So we have a relationship there, and then we can buy material, what they're making, bringing it back. And so we save on freight, and we have relationships for years with them. So I think that's really our niche market. We'll sell whatever you need.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
I'm Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. I don't ever want you to be dependent on government ever again. I want you to become financially independent. You will never, ever have to depend on socialist security for your survival. We are here to guide you to financial independence. That's imuswilkinson.com. 777-1911. That's 777-1911.